It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Hope you had a restful three-day weekend if you were off from work. It was a weekend when Donald Trump Jr.'s girlfriend tested positive for coronavirus in South Dakota after traveling there for the president's Mount Rushmore event, and a weekend when eight Secret Service agents working to protect Vice President Pence had to remain quarantined in Arizona after testing positive there, even as the president continued to minimize the risk from the virus in two successive speeches. It was a weekend when Broadway actor Nick Cordero of Bronx Tale and Waitress fame, among other plays, died of the virus at age 41, and the NYPD's chief of transportation died of it too. It was a weekend when reportedly a few hundred people continued to occupy City Hall after the budget passed last week, with cuts to the NYPD and many other things that protesters saw as bookkeeping tricks, at least as it pertained to the police. It was a weekend of 45 shootings in New York City, which makes 63 in the last week compared to 26 in the same week last year. It was a weekend when the Washington Redskins and Cleveland Indians announced they're considering changing their names. It was a weekend when the New York City beaches were open for swimming with lifeguards back on duty. Today is the day that Phase 3 reopening takes place in New York City, including nail salons and tattoo parlors with certain precautions. But indoor dining, as you probably heard, has been postponed because of the spikes in 16 other states. Governor Cuomo says anyone coming to New York from those states should quarantine for 2 weeks, but nobody is sure how he can enforce that. New Jersey's next reopening phase kicks in on Wednesday. That'll include summer camps and outdoor graduations with proper precautions. With me now, Dr. Christina Greer, Fordham University political science professor, author of the book Black Ethnics, and co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC. Hi, Christina. Welcome back to WNYC. I hope you had a restful weekend.
Yes, I did. Hi, Brian.
What do you make, first of all, of the post-New York City budget politics? Who's happy and who's not after reading the fine print of this document, which came out Wednesday to much consternation?
Yeah, well, it doesn't seem like many people are happy. I think the concern is, you know, as we think critically and imaginatively about defunding the NYPD, there seems to be indirect correlation and incorrect causation about some of the violence we're seeing over the past weekend and the efforts to decrease some of the obscene budget that the NYPD has enjoyed for quite some time.
How is the mayor, if he's been out publicly at all, dealing with the spike in shootings at a policy level?
Well, I think, you know, Brian, this is the frustrating factor in that, you know, I break up Mayor de Blasio's tenure into four sections. You know, first year, first term, we saw universal pre-K. We saw him sort of pushing forward a progressive agenda. First term, second half, kind of quiet and sort of resting on his laurels. And then the second term, first half, we saw him, you know, everywhere but New York running for the presidency. And so now we have the mayor back in the city dealing with, you know, rampant unemployment, what seems to be, you know, summer spikes in violence, which many people were concerned about. Obviously, there is a correlation between high unemployment and high violence. But the sad part is the mayor doesn't seem to have buy-in from the citizens of New York or credibility amongst his colleagues in city council because he's been relatively disinterested, seemingly disinterested for about 4 years. And so I think on a policy level, it makes it much more difficult because we already have whispers about who's going to start running in 2021. And so I think people are starting to form allegiances and alliances, planning on a future of New York without Mayor de Blasio. And we know that his relationship with the press has been tense, to be polite about it, and his patience level with articulating a vision has been little to none, especially recently. And so it's hard to get policy passed when it seems as though, on the one hand, he's distracted, and on the other hand, he's pretty annoyed when asked specific questions about moving forward.
You linked the spike in shootings likely to the spike in unemployment. I think some of the media are linking it to the defund the police movement, causing the police to back off, feeling like they're not liked, they're not wanted, they're not respected. Why should they be aggressive out there to prevent shootings? How do you weave that whole tapestry together?
Yeah, I don't subscribe to that argument. I mean, we've seen several times where the police have slowed down to, you know, try and prove a point and sort of, you know, get under the mayor's skin, and we didn't see spikes in violence. We saw, you know, we have so many police officers who actually are not necessary for policing. We can use a host of other individuals who don't have guns and bullets to actually do their jobs. So I don't think we need, you know, armed individuals to check parking meters, etc. So this to me, it's like, you know, if we look at the data, yes, we are higher this summer right now for violence than say we were last summer. But I don't think that it's, you know, because we are thinking critically about Rikers. I don't think it's because we're realizing that the police don't need billions of dollars for miscellaneous budgeting items. I think that we need to figure out what it is about structures within communities. I mean, we know we have decades of data that shows when communities are feeling economically strained and strapped, that's when we see domestic violence go up. That's when we see child abuse go up. That's when we see, you know, school truancy, and if we were in school and we didn't have to deal with a global pandemic. But we see sort of these social ills continue to increase because of, you know, real strains and concerns about economic issues. And so I think that if we actually dealt with some of the social issues at a fundamental level, as opposed to waiting for police to intervene, I think we'd see a different result. I mean, other countries and other cities have been able to deal with that. So I don't blame it on decreasing the population at Rikers. I think that we need to look more critically about what's going on in those specific communities and the resources that they have not received on a real fundamental level. And that would probably explain some of the spikes in violence. We know, I mean, Marion Barry, the mayor of Washington, D.C., you know, had it right. I mean, he saw the decrease in crime in Washington, D.C., was directly correlated with giving young people jobs. So if Mayor de Blasio decides to cut the summer youth employment program as the first thing in the budget, we know that we're going to have increases not only in crime, but in teenage pregnancy. I mean, we have data that shows this constantly. So summer youth employment is of the utmost importance to keep, you know, teenagers ages 15 to 18 busy and employed, because when you have a little money in your pocket, and as my grandfather used to always say, it's like, you know, it keeps you honest to a certain extent. And so, you know, he would always slip me a little 20, like, to keep me honest. And you realize when you have money in your pocket, it does sort of create a level of honesty to a certain extent. So we're dealing with, you know, we've talked about this on the show before, the fact that we would sacrifice our teenagers as the first, you know, line item in the budget is the reason why we're seeing some of these spikes in crime, in my political science opinion.
Did the summer youth employment program, which was the first thing that got contrasted with the lack of any cuts to the NYPD. It happened on this show, as maybe you've heard a few times during the Ask the Mayor segments, all through the spring. People from teenage groups who were mobilized around this would call the mayor and say, why are you cutting the summer youth employment program at a time when there is all this forced unemployment through the coronavirus shutdowns? And they didn't at first relate it to the NYPD, I think, until after George Floyd was killed. And, you know, the defund the police movement really broke out. But there was still this cry for not defunding that, of all things, summer youth employment program. And then eventually, at least the way it looked to me from the arc of what was taking place in the show and around the city, is that the two started to get linked. And so now we have this $1 billion cut to the NYPD, which maybe to some degree is real and to some degree is budgeting tricks, but also a restoration of the summer youth employment program. Do you know to what degree have you looked at that? Is that really back in a meaningful way, or is that too window dressing so the mayor can say the summer youth employment program is back?
Right. I mean, I have not looked at that data in sort of in-depthly, but I do know that we see, when it comes to defunding the police, there seems to be some funny business with moving numbers around, and we're just putting police officers in different line items on the budget. But also, you know, as the Summer Youth Employment Program pertains to it, we know that even if some of those jobs are reinstated, it's not the full program. And we have to be honest with ourselves. There are so many teenagers in this city who use their summer youth employment money to help their parents and their families pay their rent and pay their bills. So we are literally taking out, in some cases, sadly, these teenagers are the heads of their household. So even if we are reinstating some of the programs, it needs to be a widespread, robust program, a la Marion Barry's vision, where every single teenager who is eligible and wants a job can work. I mean, we know that, you know, so many people in impoverished communities want to work. It's just those job options and the job training isn't available. And we have so many nonprofits who have been, you know, begging the mayor and the governor to make sure that we don't sacrifice our young people just to balance a budget for the media, essentially.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is Fordham University political science professor Christina Greer, author of the book Black Ethnics and co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC. Let me ask your take, completely switching gears here, and in a way not completely, but on the Washington Redskins and Cleveland Indians considering changing their names after decades of people asking for that. I don't know if you follow the sports world at all.
Oh, yes, I do.
who are you a fan of?
Well, I was born in New York but raised in Philly, so I know it's a little odd, and I went to high school in Illinois, so I am a Mets and a Phillies and a Cubbies fan. I know that makes no sense. I also spent a lot of time in Baltimore, so I'm an Eagles and a Ravens fan. So I'm a little complicated when it comes to sports.
Yeah, that could be hard when you root for the Phillies pitcher as the ball leaves his hand and then for the Mets batter as he swings at it. But so people have been talking about this. Native American groups have been asking for it forever and ever and ever, and maybe it's a sign of the larger coming to terms with American history taking place right now, or maybe it's just a symbolic thing to cover the backsides of the owners of these teams. Did you see this over the weekend, and what do you think it does mean?
Yeah, I think that, you know, so many groups have been clamoring for this name change for quite some time, and I think it's really important, and it shows a few things. One, that protest politics can lead to policy changes, and sometimes symbolic changes are necessary and important. And two, what I'm really excited about is the coalition building that we're seeing. You know, I've said this before, when we looked at some of the Black Lives Matter protests, you saw, you know, Mexican flags with, you know, Native American protesters about pipelines, with Black Americans, Black Lives Matter folks, with DACA folks, with people who are just really concerned about a myriad of issues with the LGBTQ plus community. So we're seeing, you know, whether these are long-term or short-term coalitions, as of right now, folks are, and I put a lot of the credit with Gen Z and young people who are really leading the charge and trying to pull up this tree by the root that is, you know, white supremacy and anti-Black racism. But we cannot forget the mass genocide that occurred on this land and continues to occur, as we saw what happened at Mount Rushmore on the 4th of July. So I think it's really important. I mean, these team names should be offensive to all Americans. And the fact that they've been able to exist for so long, not just in the NFL, but also high schools across the country, you're excluding not just a particular portion of the population, but allies who are also, I am offended by the Washington R skins. Like, I don't like to even say their name. Mm-hmm. So we have dictionaries, we have a myriad of vocabulary words that we could use. There's so many ways that we can think about creative names to honor what's going on in Washington, D.C., and come up. We've seen name changes before. We've seen teams being bought and sold, you know. So I think that, you know, we can use our imagination, but where I bristle is that some of these changes are obviously for economic reasons, because they don't want further boycotts. Many folks who are in charge want these uprisings to go away. They want these conversations to go away. So this is why we're seeing rapid changes. Aunt Jemima's off the syrup bottle. You know, right, like, right. Let's just do whatever you need. stop marching so we can just get back to business as usual. But what they don't understand is that this is a racial reckoning. There is, you know, widespread racism in this nation that is palpable. So these name changes will just be the beginning, you know, and these statues coming down will be the beginning.
So let me make our first
committed to doing the hard work.
First invitation for callers in this segment to be any Native American people or people with any Native American heritage or ties who might be listening. And I don't know if any of you are out there right now. The New York City area is not a place where there's a large concentration of Native Americans. But with this news over the weekend, is it something that anybody listening right now has a personal connection to and would like to react to and tell some of the people who might be out there shrugging and shaking their heads or saying politically correct or anything like that, why this is important to you, what it's like to walk around with these team names and some of the horrible insignias and sort of chants like they do at the Atlanta Braves games. And some of you who follow baseball know what that is. What these things feel like if you are Native American yourself. 646-435-7280. 646-435-7280. If anyone who is Native American happens to be listening right now, 646-435-7280. With Dr. Christina Greer or the other things that she's talking about. Flipping segment topics again, how much doubt do you see local leaders in now about reopenings after what's been going on in other states?
I think a lot of leaders are cautiously optimistic. I definitely have my own concerns about moving so quickly to phase three, but hopefully our leaders understand that they need to continue to put forward a message of not just masks and social distancing, but also sheltering in place if you do not necessarily need to be out. I understand that many New Yorkers are frustrated and hot and would like to leave their apartments. Many people have been incredibly diligent since March, but this is not the time that we let up, because as quickly as we moved into phase three, we can very quickly move back to phase one if we're not careful. And we do not want to become one of the 22 states that's seeing surges and spikes and unfortunately hospitalizations and deaths. But we, you know, as a city have gotten things quite under control, but we know that with this mutating virus, it can obviously go in the opposite direction quite quickly.
Coronavirus quarantine enforcement by the governor. Do you know if there's a way, or is it just the voluntary restraint of people coming from those 16 states? I gather there's some degree of taking names and locations if people are coming in through airports or other, you know, official hubs. But what do you make about the possibility of enforcing this?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, I've been reading on, like, how is that possible? Obviously, yes, airports are much easier than coming in through a car with New York license plates. I mean, how does one, you know, we have so many bridges and so many tunnels, like, how does one actually police that? I mean, I think this goes back to, you know, this idea of collective action that the framers really struggled with. How do you create a society that has a singular vision when we have so many differences in how things should be done, and also how it's the nature of man to be self-interested. So this logic of collective action that we oftentimes talk about in political science is in play right now. I think we focus a lot on the sort of the rule breakers. The positive part is that we do have so many New Yorkers who are doing the right thing and so many Americans who are doing the right thing. But as far as the governor's mandate, I don't really know how that can be enforced without people self-policing themselves.
Yeah, and so far, nobody that I see is calling for anything more like closing off the airports and the train stations and the bus stations, which, of course, would be much more drastic to arrivals from those locations around the country, or stopping people in their cars when they're driving into New York. Do you remember early on in the pandemic when New York was the state with the biggest spike, that the governor of Rhode Island considered yes. for a short time actually stopping people with New York license plates at the border. And I'm not sure what the goal was. Was it to turn them back or to make sure that they quarantine in some way? And of course, people in New York raised a ruckus about that and said, what? That's going too far. This is America. We drive right. from state to state. Well, now maybe the shoe is on the other foot.
Yeah, and I mean, we saw this with upstate versus downstate New Yorkers. We saw this with certain folks from Vermont, you know, harassing people with New York plates. I mean, I think it's interesting that the international community has literally closed its borders to us. We are the country that, you know, is no longer welcome in the international community, literally and figuratively. And so I was also really fascinated by the coalitions that were formed between states early on, because this is actually, you know, when we read what the framers intended, you know, as we, e pluribus unum, out of many, we become one, and as we moved from the 13 colonies and tried to become one nation, we're seeing this Federalist versus Anti-Federalist argument kind of come up yet again about the power of individual states and governors versus the federal government. And so how do we behave as one nation when we have certain states who are bad actors who don't necessarily believe in science, and other states that are trying to comply and get the virus under control, but with such porous borders. I mean, you know, this idea that we all had one currency, that wasn't always the case. This idea that we travel freely between states, you know, tolls excluded, but that we travel freely between states is a concept the framers really struggled with. And so as we've become one country, we're seeing some of the fissures that exist when we have real differences in opinion on how to combat the coronavirus and what leadership looks like on the gubernatorial level.
And what about President Trump's son, Don Jr., and his girlfriend now in quarantine after she tested positive for coronavirus as they were out in South Dakota for the president's Mount Rushmore speech, and six Secret Service agents protecting Vice President Pence. I guess they went ahead to what was going to be a Pence Arizona event. I think that got canceled. And they're in quarantine there now. Do you think that matters politically in the presidential race?
I think so. I mean, we're still very early on, but you know, the fact that the president has chosen to politicize mask wearing says a lot. I think it's very interesting that we've slowly started to see Pence and even Governor DeSantis of Florida wear masks in ways that they never did before. We're starting to see Republican leaders from the Bush administration wearing masks openly. You know, you saw Dick Cheney's daughter tweeted a picture of her father wearing a mask with the hashtag real men wear masks. Mm. So I think that there's subtle and covert ways that Republicans are trying to push back. The problem is we haven't seen the courage of Republicans to say, wearing a mask and socially distancing and not throwing parties and not having business as usual should not be a part of it's an issue. We're trying to save lives. But it's in direct contrast with the president having a party on the, you know, the White House lawn where no one is wearing a mask, very few people are socially distancing, and he's got a few hundred people there to listen to music. So he is in denial, and has been since February, that this is something real. The problem is it is, you know, almost cratered our entire economy, and it might have some real repercussions at the ballot box if he's not able to call in his friends from Russia and, you know, influence the absentee balloting and long lines and voter disenfranchisement and voter suppression in ways that we know that he's hoping to do.
My guest is Fordham University political science professor Dr. Christina Greer, author of the book Black Ethnics and co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC, as we're talking about some local and national politics. And if you're just joining us, listeners, we spoke earlier about the Washington Redskins and Cleveland Indians. That's one football team and one baseball team, for those of you who don't follow sports, announcing over the weekend that they are going to consider changing their names. And we've invited Native Americans to call in and react to that, and we've got a whole bunch of calls. So Terry in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Terry. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I think it's really important. I just wanted to say I'm an enrolled Native American. My family is from the Ojibwe tribe in Wisconsin, and I don't want to diminish the importance of getting these teams renamed, because I do believe it is very important. But I also wanted to just say that it's important that we get Andrew Jackson's face off the money, because that's what really hurts. You know, every time I take out my wallet and I see that guy, it burns. And let's do some thinking about that.
And am I right that that was going to happen under President Obama and then it got stalled?
Yeah. Yeah. It's
so no,
you know, it just made everybody just really disappointed.
Terry, thank you so much. Thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. Tamar in Nyack, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tamar.
Hi. Thank you. I'm never first time wait caller, last first time listener. That sorry.
Glad you're
thank
on.
Thank you. I'm calling because my mother is biological grandmother was Mi'kmaq and Mexican Indian, and also on my grandma's side, we're Taino, and so it's something that's been very important to my family. And growing up in Nyack, we are the Nyack Indians, and it's a really, I don't know if you know Nyack, we're very, like, on the whole liberal, like, politically correct, forward-thinking town, and yet the very same people who care a lot about these issues would get very offended at the idea of changing the Nyack name. People would get very defensive, so it was always this, I knew that it very much upset my mother, who cared a lot about it, and so it's a relief to see this conversation happening. I've also, like, had a boyfriend who was a Redskins supporter, and it was kind of awkward when he was wearing paraphernalia for the Redskins at home. And, you know, it's just a team name, I understand, and it's just, like, they don't mean it to be in an offensive way. It's just, like, this is my team and this is who I support. So the fact that these conversations are really happening to me was a relief. Although the previous caller talking about the 20s also sounds even more important, for sure. I was relieved to hear that this was a conversation happening, because I always felt really conflicted about it. So.
How do you, Tamar, understand the defensiveness? Like, if, you know, if people put their own groups, if they're not Native American, in that position, in their shoes, and there was something that felt derogatory about their own groups, you would think it wouldn't be that hard. Like, okay, if Native Americans around the country don't want this, why are we so attached to a team name? Yet, as you say, people get really defensive about it and kind of angry.
I don't know how people defend the Redskins. That I really have no clue, because that's just a really, as your guest didn't even say the word, I totally respect that. It's a pretty disgusting word. Whereas for the Nyack Indians, the reason is often it's like, well, we are respecting, it's a way to remember the people who were here. So they see it as a form of respect. But the thing is, I think people forget that there are actually still Native people from here who live, like, a lot of our towns, Ramapo, Nyack, are all their Indian words. And those, some of those people still exist. So almost by saying it's a memory of them, it's just saying, like, well, they're all gone. And that's often the narrative about Native people in America. And I'm sure many people calling will have experienced that, where it's just like, oh, that was so sad. It's so terrible that they're gone. Oops, you know, and now we're just going to remember them. But also, that still doesn't really make sense, because imagine, like, the comparison my mom said is that we're also Jewish. And, like, imagine if someone said, if, like, the Germans had, like, the Jews team, you know, as, like, well, we're respecting them, but it's like, but that you also, not I'm saying, I mean, Germans are fine. I don't have a problem with Germans, of course, but it's just, like, it's kind of disrespectful, because it's, like, not a very good way to remember people, because it's like, well, they're gone, and whoops, where did they go? We don't know.
What if it was,
know,
like the Kinky Heads instead of the Redskins? You know what I mean? If you're talking about Jews, and, you know, how would people feel about that? And is that the equivalent? So, Tamar, thank you so much. That was a great first call to the show. I hope it won't be your last.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your show, and thank you to your guests as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So Christina, what do you think about these first couple of callers?
Well, the first caller Bringing up the idea of money, I mean, you know, we were making progress with Harriet Tubman possibly on the $20 bill. And we know that, you know, when you have a white nationalist president and administration, that's been a rollback. So hopefully it's not completely off the table. But I think that that's a really, as we think about monuments and what needs to come down, you know, we know that there are other slaveholders on the money. Other countries have had creative ways to modernize and update their money. So why are we so calcified in some of these old traditions? I mean, we can have a radical reimagination of what our society can be moving forward. You know, I mean, when we travel internationally, before we were excluded from doing so, you know, you look at other countries that have not just colorful money, but their money is different sizes, and it's much more equitable for people who are blind, you know, so that they know the differences between denominations of ones, fives, tens, 20s, and 50s. So there are ways that we can actually build in a much more equitable society on a host of levels, and not just with Harriet Tubman on the 20, but we can be much more creative that way. And then your second caller brings up a really fascinating point. You know, having grown up in the Northeast and going to school in New England, I mean, you're constantly surrounded by towns with names that are from Native American communities that have either been pushed out or silenced to the point where there's an assumption that they no longer exist. But, you know, going back to her point also about the sports teams, I mean, we do need to, you know, and she brought up the point about, you know, how would we feel if we had these offensive names about Jewish individuals in America. I mean, you know, I find the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame quite offensive, to be quite honest. I mean, it's a stereotype that, you know, is outdated and unnecessary and not true in a lot of ways, and it's still embraced, but you have a leprechaun with punching hands. I mean, I know that it's part of tradition and lots of people don't really think about it and aren't offended by it, but I am, actually, you know? I have lots of Irish friends and I don't see them as fighting leprechauns. And so I think, you know, a lot of these teams were conceptualized and drawn in an era where we didn't actually have respect for ethnicity in the way that we do now. We didn't really have alliances and coalition building the way we do. And so this is a moment to have these conversations and hopefully have some changes. I mean, I really think about all the high school teams that we played, you know, when I was in Illinois in high school, and the really offensive Native American names and the chants that go along with those names that you alluded to with the Atlanta baseball team. Again, I don't even like to say their names just to give them that power. But, you know, I think that we're at a moment where we can walk and chew gum at the same time. The same way we're having a racial reckoning about how Black Americans have been systemically disenfranchised by this nation for 401 years, I think that we can simultaneously have conversations about the mass genocide that we have inflicted upon Native communities from the executive level on down, and continue to do so with some of the pipelines and environmental racism that we inflict on protected lands and even reservations that are really dealing with coronavirus and alcoholism and lots of public health issues that need to be addressed from the government, and restitution needs to be paid. So I think that we can balance a lot of these things. As my grandmother used to say, if we can put a man on the moon, I think we can figure this out. And I do think that we can figure it out. We just need leadership on the local, state, and national level to help us do that. And right now we don't have that.
Let me get a couple of more callers in here before we run out of time. Gelvin in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Gelvin.
Yeah, hi. I'm an enrolled member and a voting member of the Western Cherokee Nation. I'm non-visible. You never know what to look at me. Mm-hmm. But I am deeply offended by the Native American names for sports teams, but also for cars, for butter. Well, I think there was some improvement made in that. My high school football team was the Indians. Well, not that it's crazy, stupid, offensive. And I think this movement is very important and decades late.
Gelvin, thank you very much. Tricia on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hello, Tricia.
Hi, yes. I wanted to call because I'm a Florida State graduate, FSU Seminoles. And one of the things that's been lost over the years in terms of the Seminole view is that the tribe has always been part of the process of the naming of the tribe originally. There are scholarships for tribal students. The tribe, the school and the tribe have agreed that if at any point it's seen as offensive to the tribe, that they'll change the name. and it's always been meant to honor Osceola and to honor the tribe. And in the process, I think there's a big difference, and many articles about the big difference over the years, by the way, about honoring a tribe and working with the tribe versus taking something from them, even if it's their name and their image. We weren't allowed to wear headdresses as students. That wasn't part of our behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always about how we honored this amazing tribe of warriors, not looking at them as a mascot, which we don't even call Osceola a mascot.
That's so interesting, and I never heard this story about the Florida State Seminoles. Do you think it's, and I hear what you're saying, it's integrated with the tribe or the nation there, and with scholarships, you're saying, and things like that. And I wonder if this is true, if it has anything to do with the fact that the name is the name of a particular Native American nation rather than just something general like Indians or Redskins, and it's in that area. Is that your experience?
You know, it could be, but I guess as a student and long since graduated, I never thought of it that way. And we just, it was never brought to us that way. We were always meant to be aware of the tribe, as they call themselves and still do, and the Seminole Nation. And there was always a connection directly, the 70 years that name has been used. I remember in 2014 and 2015 when the Redskins, all of this happened the last time, there was an article by one of the tribal leaders in the New York Times, and there were articles in the Atlantic and a bunch of other places where they talked about this is a different way of exploring and talking about and honoring this group of people through this university and its relationship to the people that they're honoring. And that's specifically the way we were always taught to think of it.
Thank you so much for your call. And Christine, I don't know if you, as a college professor, are aware or agree with the caller's interpretation. You know, I never can vouch for something that one caller says is a thing. But if you, I'm just curious if you're aware of it being different in the case of the Florida State Seminoles, and if there can be a better way.
Well, I think there definitely can be a better way. I'd be curious if we took a survey of the student body population, if they could answer, you know, 10 questions about the Seminole community and sort of the history and origin of why their team is named as such. I also think that if you are going to keep that team name as a university, and this is for universities across the country, because so many universities have these types of names, you know, are there mandatory classes on Native history? Native American history, you know, as part of the core curriculum. I mean, that's the way that if you want to keep the name, then you have to build in a robust education of your student body population and also your faculty, so you're not just donning a T-shirt on game day. And I don't think that, you know, yes, I mean, in the more baseline level, sure, it's progress that you're not wearing a headdress, but I would like to think that in the 21st century, some people would have enough respect to not do that. So, you know, the educational piece has to be university-wide from the leadership all the way down to the student population. But I would be really curious for all of the students who went to schools who have, you know, your caller didn't like to use the term mascot, but whatever we will call the Native people who were on the jerseys and in T-shirts at a sporting event, if they could answer real substantive and robust questions about the tribe that they're representing.
Yeah, interesting take on it, and something that after that caller I'm going to look more into. Maybe there'll even be a follow-up segment on Florida State and to what degree the actual Native American Seminoles do feel that that's the exception and that it's different from Redskins or Indians or whatever else, but a very interesting call. And we leave it there with Dr. Christina Greer, Fordham University political science professor, author of the book Black Ethnics, and co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC. You want to say what's coming up on the podcast?
Oh, Harry Siegel and I are still in meetings, but we did have a conversation with Richie Torres last week. So, City Council Member Richie Torres, possibly soon to be Congressman Richie Torres.
Seems likely headed for victory in that primary. And since a Republican probably will not win the congressional seat from the Bronx in the fall, therefore likely headed to Congress. Christina, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Take care.